And we're super excited to bring on the guest we have today, Ben Schuster. He worked at BlackRock, which if you've been in real estate for any amount of time, you've heard that name, and then moved over into the private equity real estate space. So we're going to get a ton of technical knowledge from this gentleman today, and we're also going to get some really great advice, even though he's only been at it for 6 months, on parenting. So super excited to share the knowledge that Ben has in both of these spaces. And so without further ado, Ben, thanks for being here and welcome to the show.
Well, that's kind of the point of this episode or our platform a little bit, is that I've been a guest on a bunch of podcasts. Trevor has too, where it's, hey, what's the W-2 to what's the story on real estate? Why'd you start your
company? Yeah.
And I went over to being an entrepreneur and don't get me wrong, I've enjoyed those. But, and I would love to hear your take on this. But, my son, he turned two this last December. My daughter will be born here in April. But I had a lot of dads, or a lot of, I'll call it older businessmen who I knew prior to me being a dad, who would give me advice about, going on. And a lot of these guys would just straight up say, like, oh, don't ever get married, don't ever do it. And not all of them, but, a few. But it wasn't until after my son came out that I had this experience where I met other dads who started really opening up and being like, oh my God, like, you have a kid, that's so great. And then they would start telling you about their kids, and then they would kind of start like all of a sudden I felt like I had this, like I'd been inducted into this other body of people who had also made the decision to have kids and were all really happy about it. And that was something that I just didn't, I always wanted kids, but I didn't really know what kind of community there was amongst dads until I was a part of it.
That's someone that was mad that they were
able to share with them.
They had kids.
Say it again. None of them were mad they were a father, but it was the individuals who were, and that's why I call it the grass is greener. It was only a few. But they were outspoken about it for whatever specific thing they were dealing with in their life at that time. But the majority of the other ones who had kids, they loved being dads, but they just weren't as vocal with a non-father about those things. They just, as young, they're talking to some guy in his 20s who's being a single 20-year-old dude. They're not going over, telling me about how excited they are about their kids, first word or some funny story about, something cute that their child did where, like my wife and I still now, we want to text people when our son happens to say Hakuna Matata watching Lion King. I mean, we're just like over the moon excited about this minorly not big at that.
It's just so impressive, It's funny how we have we got this genetic coding that is makes us love these things, because in all practicality, especially in those early years, they get in the way. They're interruptive, they're needy, and it's almost like we're not even allowed to say it. We're just like, oh, I just love my kids,
Well, they're little, joke? Dopamine dealers. They're so much work, and then you hug them and you're like, oh my God, this is so worth it. But Ben, I guess, as the hosts here, we're talking too much. So let's go over to you. So let's hear the story. New dad, she's just 6 months. Let's hear the story with that. We'll get into the business.
Yeah, no, thanks, Max and Trevor. And it's a pleasure to be on here. I have a little girl, first time dad, 6 month old baby girl named Riley, as you mentioned. And I just was kind of lighting up on the inside hearing you guys talk about being a dad and making that transition from, let's just say, early 30-year-olds and your 20-year-olds, you're a bachelor and you kind of run around with your buddies and they talk about, oh yeah, I don't want to have kids, or I want to delay, I want to focus on my career. And my wife and I were we always had aspirations, and it would have been a deal breaker for both of us if we weren't open to building a family and having kids. And ever since she came out and becoming a dad, Max, I agree with everything you just said. It's opened up in a whole new world, especially to what I do personally. I'll talk on the career side, but even just more importantly, it's my biggest accomplishment I've ever had is becoming a dad, and it's changed me in more ways than I could even imagine, for my mindset, the way I think about what really matters in life. I like that when I talk to people about it, that are dads or maybe are not dads, it really put horse blinders on, and it's made me more focused on the really what matters in life. And it's been monumental to not only like my relationship with my wife and just our family, but also my career, my mental health, and just why I do what I do. And it gave me so much more purpose and allowed me to connect more with my colleagues, as well as our investors and our partners on a much more deeper basis. And like you said, the dopamine dealers, every morning, I'm the one that wakes up around, when she wakes up, let's say maybe it's 4:30, maybe it's 6 a.m. But I love getting up and going to see her, and my eyes are barely open and I'm tired. But as soon as I see her and she gives me a big smile and laughs, it's like, it just warms my day and just gives me that dopamine. And then I'll spend time with her in the morning. And well, my wife, she can get some sleep because she's usually the one that's waking up in the middle of the night. So it's been quite the journey, and I want more already. So my wife and I are kind of gearing up for the next one as well. And yeah, I'm happy to go into it more, but I always strongly encourage young males that are, are trying to push the family fatherhood and the kids to the side while they focus on their career. I always tell them, if you have a fiance, if you have a serious girlfriend, you have a wife, like have kids, and it will exponentially propel your career and everything that you do in life. It's such a huge motivator. And then you'll make sure that you're doing things for the right reasons, I feel. But yeah, so thanks for having me. And I love talking about being a dad. And I also love talking about real estate, but I think I prefer talking about being a dad more than anything else in the world. So my wife, she's a first grade teacher. So she's very disciplined. So we have her on some pretty tight schedules, but she has the regression. So right now, we just sleep trained her. So she's actually in her crib for the first time. I just put away the bassinet last week. So it's still very new. Last night, she did sleep through the night. She woke up at 4:00. My wife and I look at each other like, okay, let her cry. I think it was only 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and she went back to bed, which is amazing. So, we wake up in the morning, we give each other a high five. But last night, it was like an hour of crying. And that is the toughest thing in the world, is when you hear your child crying, but we know that we can't go in there and pick her up because it will instill bad habits, and she'll start to tie the fact that she can cry and we'll go get her. So we're going, we're almost on the other side, but we're still working through it. I mean, at 6 months, I think anyone can relate with a 6 month old. You're just at the, you're just at the sweet spot, but there's still a lot more hard work that needs to be done in the coming days and weeks.
Well, first of all, when you say you feel bad when your baby cries for an hour, is that you or is that your wife?
It's both of us, right? And so it's both of us, and it depends on the cry as well. Sometimes it's a little bit of whining. So I don't mind as much when it's the whining, it's the making the noise, it's kind of the soft cry. But if she's hysterical, then, we'll go in there and check on her because, there's different cries, right? I think, but yeah, we've gotten better. Just my wife, she's amazing, and she was, I think, put on this earth to be a mom. I really do feel that way. So we really try to instill good habits because it's only going to make our lives better, and it's going to make her a better sleeper. And so it's tough, but we fall into that camp where you can't.
Well, I was going to say, are you doing the taking care of babies?
Yes, we do the taking care of babies. So, Kara, I believe I had to watch all those videos before my wife, she subscribes to Kara. And that's been a huge, huge help. Actually, one of my buddies, I was just at his baby shower over the weekend. He's having his first child, and we sent him over all of, the documents and the videos, and now him and his wife are watching it. And I totally believe it. And I basically just do whatever my wife says. And so she's a follower.
We found that our son would go to sleep at about 17 minutes. We would do have you seen this, Trevor? And if you're going through this right now, Ben, you can correct me, but it's, where you go in, you put the kid down, and then you leave them for like 5 minutes. And you go in, you check on them, you give them a hug. You're not supposed to pick them up. You can kind of go down, you can pat them on the back, let them know you're there so that they're not thinking that you've like abandoned them. Then you leave the room for 10 minutes. And then you come back in, or it's, you know, it's kind of like a doubling the amount of time they're in there. And we found that our son would pass out, and I mean like knocked out, about 17 minutes. And, you know, they say if you do about 2 weeks, then, you know, you kind of have this trained. But we were, I mean, I think everyone struggles with it. I mean, I am still very guilty of like taking my son when he's crying. Because if it's an hour, we probably wouldn't, I don't think we'd be able to make it for an hour. I'd probably end up, you know, lying down on the, we have a couch that's in the baby's room, put him on my chest, have him go to sleep. Now that he's, you know, over the age of two, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. Now he can actually get out of the bed on his own and come wake up in the morning.
Just out of curiosity, do you guys, one of the things that my wife is very critical on is like the schedules, the nap schedules during the day. And that's another Kara thing. And so even when she goes out and gets her nails done, or maybe she goes to a happy hour with a girlfriend and she leaves me with the baby, she's writing the schedule out for me on a sticky pad. And in my mind, I'm like, I know what to do, but she's very, regimented. Do you guys, I mean, I know you have a 2-year-old now, so you're kind of out of that, you know, that the initial fog, but
not even close on my end, dude. Our kids, like, it's a whirlwind. I got a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my wife works in one of my businesses with me, and the kids basically just follow her around watching an entrepreneur mom all day long, and they're just, that's it, keep up, you know. So there's no schedule, it's just keep up with mom.
There you go. Yeah, we're very blessed in that my wife, being a teacher, it's a pretty demanding job, and she has since decided she's not going to go back. And so adjusting to that, so her being a full-time mom, been a huge, huge help. And I know not everyone can be in that position. And, you know, while you just need a budget for it, and, you know, now that, especially like what we do, it's a long-term game. And you know, we'll grow out of it from a financial standpoint, but that's, you know, I don't say that without recognizing that there's a lot of people probably listening to this and around the world that are not able to do that. Or, you know, there are moms that wouldn't want to be home 24/7 as well. And so I'm very, you know, and I think it worked, you know, everyone needs to, you know, it's not like listen to this, this is the way to do it. Everyone figures out what works best for them. And I think that that's what's beautiful about having kids. It's just realizing that everyone's different. Every kid is different. And you just got to be what works for your family.
So what was the impetus to sleep train or to watch taking care of babies? Was that your wife?
My wife, actually, her cousin has a handful of young kids. And for our baby shower, she gave my wife a subscription to Taking Care of Babies. And then from there, you know, my wife started digging into, you know, the Taking Care of Babies and Kara. And then, you know, she was loved it. And then she would say, hey, would you be, you know, while she's like 8 months, 7 months pregnant, can we watch these videos together? And I thought that was a really cool time for her and I to bond. You know, we would just, you know, lay in bed, I'd throw my laptop on and we'd watch a couple of those videos. And personally, like, I've never changed a baby's diaper before. I'm not the guy at the party like, hey, let me hold your baby before I had a kid, right? I didn't really care. But watching those videos and just getting ready, and you're really excited too as a first time dad. And it was cool for our relationship because we could just kind of bond over something. And it, you know, I think sometimes like a common interest, you know, kids are perfect for relationships because it's a common interest, right? You could bond over. But we did the same thing for my buddy. We gave him a subscription to Taking Care of Babies, and I encouraged him, you know, hey, watch these videos with your wife. And, you know, we run into each other all the time. He's like, yeah, we watched a handful of videos last night. And you know, I'm obviously very new to this, you know, 6 months, so I'm not talking from that much experience, but, you know, going through it, it was something that I highly recommend because it's like, where do I go? Where do I start? You know, there's the baby books, but now with technology, it's a lot easier to watch these. Like,
no, it's really impressive because honestly, man, like, I mean, I've been exposed to a lot of mothers now, and it's pretty rare that a mother will sleep train a child within the first 6 months of their life when it's their first kid. It's usually like, when I see it just from personal experience, it's the second kid where they're like, I learned my lesson, I'm not doing that again.
I disagree.
Really?
I see it the other way.
You
know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the, and I, you know, and I don't know, when we say like, how is this, what I'll actually say is that I'm not sure that there is a one, you know, the right, that this is the way, you know, you do with kids. I've had therapists say to me flat out that we are in a society where we are training kids to have detachment disorders because we are not giving them enough attention at a young age, and that there wasn't this process up until the last 50 years where the mom wasn't directly available to raise the kid, like within the household. The moms go back to work. We send kids to daycare, schooling, and the kids are getting detachment disorder. And that sleep training was even this process that was created because you had to have two parents working because society had gotten so expensive that you need to have two parents, you know, doing that. So, you know, I think the sleep training works. And I think that it is something where, you know, and Kara, who does this, you know, she kind of talks about that with making sure that when you're going back in there, you're still going in there to give them a hug and let them know you have not forgotten about them. You're just in the other room and you're being the coach to helping them sleep. But first parents, oh yeah, like we are so much calmer now. We were real militant on the nap time within the first 6 months, a year. Even like some of my wife's like first arguments were like, you know, we'd get invited to a kid's birthday, 1-year-old party. Well, what about nap time? Are we going to make nap time? Is it this? Is it, you know, what about this? And we finally said like,
no, yes, hell yeah.
Kids on our schedule, not the way the other way around. We had to make a little bit of a, hey, no, like it'll be okay. Like kid will be okay. We will get a nap. And then it was certain events that really helped change our mindsets on that. We had a Thanksgiving, we had a bunch of people at the house, and our son would not go down for a nap time, and it caused this big stress. Oh no, we got to get the food ready, and kid won't take a nap, and grandma won't take a nap, and we skipped nap time, and guess what? Everything was fine. Everything was fine. Slept fine that night. We did not, you know, because you hear these horror stories. Oh well, if he doesn't take a nap, he won't sleep well that night. And then he won't take a nap ever again. And, you
know, a little strategic, but we have a strategy now. Kids fall asleep in cars easy, and you know we're running around looking at real estate stuff. You playing with scissors too? It's so easy. But yeah, our kids, you know, especially when they're younger. Our older doesn't hardly ever take a nap anymore. The 4-year-old, but our 1-year-old still very much does, and she just falls asleep in the car. And we'll leave it running in the driveway for a freaking hour. Who cares? All the time. More times than I can count.
And I love what you said, Max, is like having, you know, not making your schedule revolve around your little one, but having them adapt and learn to revolve their schedule around yours. So my wife and I, we've always loved to go out to dinner, to go out and have drinks. And so we take Riley everywhere with us, and you know sometimes that runs through her nap time, and we have one of those baby carriers, and so what we'll do is if it's time for a nap, you know, we're out having drinks even for St. Patrick's Day that passed and not too long ago. We went down by the beach. We're based in San Diego. We went down by the beach and had lunch and had a drink and stuff, and you know we're not looking at the time and saying, oh, we need to get going because she needs to take a nap. We'll just strap her on and then stand up, and you know she'll fall asleep. And even if it's 20 minutes, 10 minutes, okay, she got a nap. All right, she's good for a while. We'll bring all the formula or the, you know, the breast milk and whatever it is out with us. And she's a great baby, and I think she can sleep with a lot of noise. And I know there are some parents that are like, okay, but you don't want to take them out for the first 6 months and expose them. And I you know, depending on what you're a believer in, we take her everywhere with us. And and yeah, and she's really good, and it's amazing how well they adapt. And the only other thing I was going to say too about what you kind of touched on, Max, is I was reading something about how like there's very few mammals in the entire entire world that their babies don't sleep with their mothers in the early parts of life. And so I know like that's a big like thing, you know. Well, you know, one of the health concerns is like have them in the bassinet because you don't want to roll over and suffocate them and those things. And then the sleep training, it can seem a little aggressive at times. And I get there's always two points, you know, there's always like the other side. So like I said in the beginning, it's like whatever works for you guys.
It's a really good point. Are there any other mammals that will not sleep with their children? Are we the only one?
No, they all know it's just humans. And that's kind of why I was bringing it up with like the whole like work thing. You know, and co-sleeping is the most frowned upon in the U.S. Most other countries don't have the same concerns over the co-sleeping, you know, where the parent, you know, and you read horror stories about it, you know, where a kid will get rolled over on by the parents or, you know, something.
I mean, it happens in nature too. Like you, if you ever breed dogs, the mother's going to kill some puppies in her litters, you know?
Yeah, within the co-sleeping thing, I mean, we don't do it for the concerns that everyone, you know, brings up. You know, we had our son in the bassinet. He was always swaddled. And there's sometimes where I read some of these articles, like I do kind of go like, you know, what was going on with the parents? Were they smoking weed? Were they drunk? Like what was happening that they were so passed out that they were unaware that one of these things happened? You know, I don't know. And I also would never really even want to ask that question because it's such a tragic event if that occurs. It's not like one of those things you want to be, oh, well, you know, what was the, you know, reason for it? We just don't do it. You know, to as much as we can not do it, you know, but I talk to parents about it and they go like, yeah, we try not to co-sleep, but you hear about everyone who kind of does
in some ways. We had a pediatrician until COVID happened. Then like we literally haven't been back since, but it was, we were visiting her for, you know, shots or whatever and asked her about sleeping and she literally broke into tears. It's like, oh my God, I just had one of my patients literally just kill her kid sleeping with her.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And she's a very sweet lady. You know, she's a great pediatrician, honestly. And just, yeah, we just brought it up and it had just happened. And it's like, she was like, you know, I'm a convert, if you will. Don't sleep. Just don't do it. Why take the risk?
Yeah, we don't. We haven't. But I guess I was just mentioning in regards to that. It's, you know, it's primarily a U.S. thing that we're so cognizant of that on. Okay, so we got the background on, you know, Ben and you and your wife and Riley. So, you know, and we don't. So regarding you on the business side, worked for BlackRock for 7 years. And, you know, give us some of your work background, you know, within that, you know, I'll call it W-2 role to where you are, you know, today.
Yeah. So from undergrad, I went work for BlackRock, started on the capital markets desk, which was effectively a trading desk. So I was trading fixed income and equities. And so I would be in, you know, in front of my Bloomberg around like 5 a.m. and then leave sometimes around like, you know, midnight if I was tying out trades and certain things. So it was a pretty demanding job, but it was a great place to begin your career because you're really in the cockpit of the global financial markets and just understanding risk and managing risk and communicating. It was a fantastic way to kind of start off my career, but I always had a passion to get into private equity real estate. And so I did that for a couple of years and then I transitioned entirely to raise institutional capital for the private equity real estate and debt platform. So I did that for about 3 years. Which was fantastic. So I was working under a senior managing director, going out and meeting with large institutional allocators, so pension funds, endowments, family offices, and was raising money for our commingled funds, which were core and value add across multiple asset classes. And then I really wanted to get into the trenches on the investment side. And so I was fortunate enough to then move over from that role onto the investment team where I oversaw a portfolio of industrial, retail, and class A multifamily and also did a little bit of development at BlackRock. And then while I was at BlackRock, this was in 2021 or 2022, I met Blake Comfort, who's the owner of Comfort Capital, at a local Starbucks. I was sitting there with my wife and our dog on a Saturday morning having coffee, and he rolled in and I think he had a hat on that said like a trailer park revolution or something funny. And my broker, you know, saw him. I was like, oh, you do mobile home parks. You know, I'm an insurance guy or I'm in a broker and we cover those. And my ears perked up. It's an asset class that I was really fascinated with and never met somebody that has done it or done it very well. And so as he walked out, I stopped him and asked him if he'd be open to grabbing coffee, just, you know, if I could learn more. And he was really intrigued that I worked for BlackRock and on the investment team, and he wanted to learn more about just what we were doing. And we became friends over 2 years, just talking about deals and family, some of the stuff we're talking about now. And he approached me in December of 2022, asking me if I ever thought about leaving BlackRock and coming and joining his company as a partner and helping, you know, lead the capital formation and investor relations function for Comfort, as well as sitting on the deal team. And I was really intrigued. Also a lot of risk, right? Just because you're leaving a very large established company. I was in a role that I worked many, many years to get into. And I was, you know, continuing to grow within that. But we, you know, it was something where, you know, it was something that I think was, you know, godly in a way, and felt very drawn to it. And so, yeah, we negotiated a contract, and they started in May of last year, and we had our biggest year on record ever. You know, in 2023, we brought in about $50 million of capital, $20 million of which is 1031 capital, and $30 million, which was fresh equity. And it's been quite the ride. And Max, I see your little one back there. Very cute. I'm excited to get in the toddler stage.
I had to mute real quick. No, I want to go back to all of these big numbers that you were going in, that you're raising for. You know, we have a very big push to bring in a role that you are doing for Comfort at our organization now.
Yeah,
and because, you know, we're just finding that we're so bogged down doing operations and looking for deals, and, you know, and this is something that you know, the solopreneurs really realize very quickly, is the scaling is really the part of it. You need to have a major player who has, y'all call it the Ben Schuster experience level of being at that trading desk, understanding basis point spreads on deals, understanding the risk adjusted returns for each individual portfolio you're managing, how much capital is going in from those different major organizations. And this is one thing, I guess I'll do a quick sidebar on this within, you know, for listeners. The major players of the real estate space who are putting out large swaths of capital are risk adjusting those dollars, where it might look like you've got a fund that's got $500 billion or, you know, some major amount, and you go, oh, well, they invest in real estate. When in reality, they invest on very specific expected returns with very expected specific risk adjusted returns attached to that. 17 IRRs are your higher risk value add deals. But they might put out a lot of money on an 8% to 10% expected return for a core asset because they're sure, or I shouldn't say sure, but they don't expect there to be any risk in those. 9% to 10%, they can have a relatively sure expectation of having those numbers hit. 17, 18 IRRs, higher leverage deals, maybe you got more moving pieces for value add. Those deals aren't so sure, but you find out for large portfolios or people who are putting out large pots of capital that when they blend all those things out, they do better overall in the entire portfolio. Large groups or guys who have Ben's experience have, you know, experience in placing money for these very specific capital expected returns based on those risk adjusted expectations. Is that correct, Ben? I kind of said some things for you.
I think you hit it right on the head. Okay. That's very well said. And it's a really important distinction for all real estate investors to understand and to know. And when I first came onto the team, there's an article, if you go on our website, you could pull it down. I discussed this very topic, and I did it very strategically to educate our investors that you need to look at returns from a risk-adjusted basis. It's not about looking at the shiny object of the guy that's projecting a 25% IRR. You need to look at what are the assumptions that are in place and what's the amount of risk he's taking to get into that projected return. And you're exactly correct. The core plus mandates are the majority of where capital gets allocated from an institutional level, and value add returns generally around 15%. That's a quad IRR, 15 to 17% IRR. That is where most syndicators like to play in, and it's a competition who has the best returns. And we were just in a, call it, you know, 10 plus year, 15 year bull market, where it was pretty easy on any strategy to receive and see out, large outsized returns. And the market dynamics have changed completely over the last 24 months. And it's going to be those skilled operators that are very targeted, that have very conservative underwriting, that are going to be able to still perform those returns that are more based on a historical basis. So for like core, call it 7 to 9%, core plus maybe 9 to 12%, value add, you know, call it 12 to 17%, and then everything above that opportunistic. And it's very important for investors to understand that if you're going and allocating capital, understanding what the amount of risk that you're taking for those dollars.
Yeah, that's the, you know, we say the shiny object. That's, I think, what a lot of the syndicators unfortunately end up in the bucket of, is that they talk to retail investors and the retail investors don't actually understand that if they only invest in high risk 20 IRR deals, that you have a chance of having, you know, a loser in the bunch, you know, and, you know, absolutely. And the one can be, you know, one that can, you know, remove a lot of returns for the rest of the dollars they're putting out. But, you know, and in that way, you end up, you know, trying to find deals that are syndicated assets because you're competing with some of those other investor groups who are, or, you know, individual investors who are only putting out dollars based on that, that shiny object syndrome of the highest IRR they can see. And, you know, that's why for us, you know, we're trying to do just more core plus. That's it. Core plus deals.
So, Ben, let me ask you, how does one, you know, for people listening, this term risk-adjusted returns gets thrown around a lot. And I feel like there's different ways to do it. So what is, you know, like, what are the basics or broad strokes? How does one go down the road of identifying the risk and making appropriate adjustments?
Yeah, I mean, like, we could boil it down to very simplistic real estate terms. So from a risk adjusted basis, without going into the, you know, the algebra, the statistics behind it, like looking at like standard deviations and so forth, basically all it really boils down to is what are the assumptions that you're projecting to get to that return. So it could be occupancy. Are you buying something that's maybe 80% occupied? Are you buying something that's 95% occupied? It could be, if it's a value add project, it could be projected rent growth. So are you looking at turning units, doing a, you know, a renovation on those units, and then turning keys at a much higher rent? And then what's the probability of getting to that rent? And then how long is it going to take to then turn those units and then renovate them? What's the amount of vacancy that you're expecting on those? It could be simple things like if there's, you know, it really all depends on the strategy. If you want to throw out an asset class, I'll boil it down to what I would think. But, you know, it really is as simple as looking at the amount of assumptions that the operator is assuming to get to those projected returns. And I think for any limited partner or investor, it's always really critical to then ask them, okay, what are your rent assumptions? What are your vacancy assumptions? What's your exit cap? What is the CapEx that you're projecting to put in here? What are the amount of reserves that you plan on holding? Those like simple questions, you could really understand, you know, how realistic it is to then get to that backed in IRR. You know, I think any person that's allocating money should ask for the pro forma, look at the rent growth, look at where market rents are today. What are they projecting market rents are? If it's a 5-year hold, where do they end up? Where do they think they're going to land at? What are market rents currently? And that's that same submarket for maybe higher quality assets. What are they getting? What are some of the lower quality assets around there? And just really take a market survey and understanding that. And it really, like, you tell me an IRR and I can pull up my model right now and I could spit it out, right? Because I can you essentially can make any return on paper.
Do you use a lot of standard deviations in making your risk adjustments? So you come up with those?
No, I mean, you're for real estate, it's a discounted cash flow, right? So what are you discounting at? So, you know, that's important. That could be looked at as a sign of risk, right? So like, what is the, if you're taking a discount rate, should be at least north of 5%, right? Because risk-free money in CDs is 5% right now. So I think that that's an important thing. What are they discounting their cash flow on? So that's a really kind of key metric to look at for understanding how they're projecting their returns. It's just how much are they discounting the cash flows by, if that makes sense.
You know, look, for a lot of the stuff that we used to do, it was based on, you know, how much, and you hit it on the head, but, you know, what's the renovation budget and how much you have to spend to get to, you know, performance rents. And for certain assets that worked on, you know, we'd have a governor on the specific amount of particular renovation dollars. We'd say, hey, you know, we can't have a renovation budget that exceeds X% of the total deal cost, because they want to focus on you know, not having asset or disruption, which meant that you had to debug your performance numbers off current basis and not these, not a target of something that really is untested. That was a big one that we would look at, you know, frequently.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people got in hot water because in 2021, when you're buying, like, say, like a sub four cap or a four cap property in the Sun Belt markets, and you saw rent growth nationally from 2021 to 2022 grow by 20% in some of these Sun Belt markets. It got up to, like, you know, north of 30%, you know, just shy of 40%. And then when you're buying something at a four cap that's a Class B multifamily project, and then your pro forma is projecting future rent growth. Well, that rent growth didn't materialize, right? Because you had a 40-year high of supply that came and hit online, and it's that supply is continuing to be delivered. And anyone that's been an asset manager, has been an investor for some time, knows that when a developer comes out of the ground with a Class A or a new product, what they're really incentivized to do is to stabilize that asset to then sell it, right? So stabilization from, like, the agencies is going to be 90 to 95%. And so in order to get there, what they end up doing is putting in concessions. So this could be 1 month free. This could be, you know, 1 month free, 2 months free. Maybe they lower the rent slightly, do a 6 month lease in order to turn and get that unit leased up. So then they can then go and sell it and put on stabilized debt on that asset. So what happens when you're the college student or the young professional that's living in the older building that's right across the street? And generally multifamily units turn, you know, 50% of the rent roll in a given year, just on average. Maybe it's 40% if it's, you know, a more stabilized, sticky asset base or, you know, tenant base. But what you're going to do is you're going to say, oh, I'm paying $2,000 a month in my rent. This is a nicer property across the street. They're giving me 1 month of free rent. Maybe it's $1,900, but I'm only going to be in here for about a year. If I take that free rent, adjust it across, you know, my annual kind of rent budget, I'm going to be saving, you know, call it $250 a month in rent. So it doesn't cost me that much to move. I don't have a lot of stuff. I'll just go and move over to the nicer building. So what you're seeing is you're seeing rent growth and occupancy decrease across multifamily. And if you bought an asset at a four cap, if you needed to get to your pro forma by putting on some floating rate debt to increase your LTV, and then you're pegged to SOFR, and SOFR has jumped up 25 times over the last couple of years, then you're really underwater and you're in a tough spot. And so, yeah, you got to be really careful. We like to buy deals that have what I call embedded rent growth. So where we're buying really under market assets that we know that market rent today is much higher than what we're buying at. So that spread is what I like to call embedded rent growth. And then we get there in probably 3 years where market is today, because we don't want to crank rents on our tenants overnight. But then in 3 years, what I believe is going to happen is that a lot of this new supply that's coming online is going to get absorbed. And then because of where debt's at, construction feasibility, doesn't make sense on a return on cost to build. So what will happen is that we're going to be undersupplied in the next 2 years. Everything that's hitting online will get absorbed. And I think that rent growth for multifamily will just go on another tear. And then us in the NHC space, we're just the tortoise and they're the hare. So I feel like as long as we can buy deals that are under market today based on a proven market rent, that in 2 to 3 years, that multifamily will lead the race again and it will shoot up once all the deals, you know, all that absorption has happened. So long-winded answer, but hopefully that gives listeners some context of how I think about the market today.
Yeah, it's a very similar factor that occurred after the last recession. Was that, you know, you had no new developments or coming to the ground. You know, they had buildings that were finished being built, you know, I'll call it in like 2009, but then you didn't have anything that was breaking ground, you know, from really 2008, nothing was breaking ground, 2009, nothing was breaking ground, 10, 11, 12, nothing. And you had this dearth of new supply that was not hitting the market. And then that caused a shortage of housing in addition to massive inflation from how much the government printed out, you know, starting in, you know, 2013, huge rise came up. And now we're in a similar factor where you've got, you know, what's going to happen here again is a lack of new shovels entering the ground during this period of time. And then they'll start again, you know, in a couple of years where, you know, those numbers for new construction will start happening. But there's going to be a shortage of new developments that are going to be hitting the market next, I'll call it, a lot of new developments are hitting the market within the next 18 to 30 months, and there'll be a dearth after that period of time.
Yeah. I mean, Max, you hit it right on the head. We have never caught up from what happened in the 2008 financial crisis, nor will we probably ever catch up. There's 6 million housing units short in the United States. And this current kind of recession that we're going through is only going to exacerbate the problem. So the tailwinds for our space, you know, the mega trends are still much in our favor. This is kind of a short term, you know, for multi, this is kind of a short term circumstance that happened when the Fed funds rate jumps up 25 times and, you know, faster than any point in the last 40 years. And just where the dynamics were, where just basically debt was free and where cap rates got so compressed. And so I don't think that you're going to see a ton of distress, but, you know, we are probably going to go through a couple of years where there is going to be some operators that might be hurting. And those operators, most every time, if I ask somebody that, you know, and one of our investors that also does multifamily, and they tell me, hey, my distributions on this deal got cut it by 2/3, I'm kind of pissed off. I trust you guys more. I always say, oh, well, hold on. These guys, I know, right? They're very good. Let's just, like, when did they buy it? Let me guess, 2021. Yeah, it was a 1031 exchange that they rolled. And so, you know, they took some floating rate debt. The fundamentals are still great, right? It's just kind of where your entry point was and getting too aggressive at a time where the market peaked.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really, and I think that's, and it's funny because a lot of deals we were underwriting for all 21 and 22, we were having trouble making sense of anything. We were being smoked on every offer out. I mean, and you know, in the rearview mirror, I feel very vindicated now. Because we weren't pushing on number, we weren't pushing pricing. You know, we were looking at things going like, hey, this is where it is. And, you know, and we're still looking at, you know, going back out. But, you know, it's so funny because even now with the market in decline, I was talking to a broker this morning about how many units was to come out of the ground at Phoenix here within the next, it took 30 months. And, you know, and we're talking exactly about a lot of things we're mentioning now with concessions and things that are happening. And it's, you know, and it's definitely a very precarious time in regards to, you know, what's going to happen with supply and a lot of those decreasing rents as a result of the absorption of the market. But there's also, you know, on this outside risk question, I ask this constantly because you kind of said it. Are we going to see a lack of jobs market? Is there going to be a recession that affects employment? And that's when we're not really seeing right now, and at least not, you know, on our operation side where we have people who are unemployed, you know, looking to rent units. But I also just recognize how much inflation is just so underreported. And I don't really know if there's even a method by which the government, I mean, the government does all this inflation talk where they really bring it up in a sheer factor of how many or what the cost of a gallon of milk is, or, you know, what the energy costs, have this method by which they're calculating out what inflation is. And that in reality, what they should really be doing is looking at the total money supply and then adjusting it based on how many new dollars they are printing every day. In reality, that's what they should be doing. They shouldn't be looking at it as inflation. They should be looking at it as devaluation of dollar based on percentage of whatever they want to call that. It's time they're doing the report. Because the amount that they are printing and devaluing the US dollar is really the factor that comes back into when you talk about replacement costs for units, what's the cost to build, you know, a new unit, you know, how much is the current dollar being deflated, is really, you know, I think a better way to actually calculate, you know, what's happening within the government being in multiple wars all over the world. And, you know, and Trevor and I have talked about this quite a bit, but, you know, the amount of immigrants that are coming over into the country, they're going to have to stabilize this body of people within the U.S. Whatever that means when I say stabilize, whether that's in training for jobs, whether that's in housing, whether that's in building facilities to you know, have them be in locations that are, you know, safe. That's going to be something the government's going to further have to print more money to do. And when I look back at physical assets, I still go, you know, this is the best place for dollars to be invested, as long as some of those outside risk factors are taken care of. You know, groups that have to reduce distributions. The biggest factor that I look at when people are calling me up and they go, hey, what do you think of this deal? And I don't, and you know, and I generally don't have time to underwrite every one of their deals, you know, because you're right. We talk about an investor looking at a deal and say, let me see your pro forma and let me see, you know, what your assumptions are. We talk to a lot of investors and they don't have that analyst background to be able to even take that data and figure it out. And I'll have guys call me frequently. Hey, can you underwrite this deal? And generally, I don't have the time. I don't have time to go through it for other guys. But, you know, but what I say is, take their existing rents today, not with a value add, not with anything else, and make sure they're able to cover their debt service on the upfront without doing any renovation work or not doing any other major changes to the asset. And if the asset still covers and is safe based on those inflation factors, and they're going to hold it for 5 years, I think the deal will probably be okay. But then I generally have guys calling back and they go, hey, you're right. That deal didn't cover based on what it currently was. They weren't going to make the deal work unless it was, you know, unless they hit their target rents. And when I look at that, you know, generally I just say, all right, well, you just have to do more homework. I don't mean that to me doesn't mean the deal isn't still a good opportunity. It just means that, you know, you have to do more research to actually check that risk adjusted return.